Good evening and Shavua Tov. On behalf of the Yavne Academy, it is my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's program, Positive Jewish Parenting. A few quick thank yous. First of all, I want to express our gratitude to the Orthodox Union for partnering with us to bring this positive parenting program to the broader Jewish community. I want to acknowledge the support of the Yavne Parents Association and the many local community shuls that lent their supports. From Yavne's side, I want to thank Dr. Aliza Froelich and Mrs. Gail Krakow, who worked tirelessly to bring this dynamic program to our community. I want to express our gratitude to Dr. David Pelkovitz, Dr. David Yammer, Mrs. Gila Zellinger, Mrs. Nancy Basov, for joining us this evening and lending their expertise. And I want to express my gratitude to Mr. Frank Buchweitz, the National Director of Community Services and Special Projects at the OU. I see, Frank, you have a large cheering committee here, Frank. I think you're yelling for parents. But, Frank, we really appreciate all you did to make this evening come to fruition. It's my pleasure now to ask you to please come up and say a few words. Does anybody know the score of tonight's football game? What is the score, Rabbi? 21-16 Giants. We're in the third quarter. In spite of that, we have a great turnout of many men tonight. And I want to thank everybody for being here. Just want to share with you, first of all, I was here this week on Thursday, and I walked through the school, and in walking through the school, I observed the following. A tremendous hakaras hatov in terms of the relationship of the kids to the teachers, and as a former principal of secular studies in yeshivas and day schools, I can tell you that the atmosphere was an extremely positive one. I noticed the interaction of Rabbi Knapp with the kids, and it was just phenomenal. The relationships that existed here, you as parents should be extremely proud of and proud of your leadership. And the nicest part in coming here tonight, I saw a few young people who are here. I said, what are you doing here? They said, we're here because we're here to help on Chesed. So I said, great, can I have your names? Because usually the kids are ignored. I don't want to ignore them. I want to acknowledge Jordan Yehudiel, forgive me if I mispronounce anybody's name, Philip Meyer, Ben Atwood, Ari Putterman, Miriam Fisher, Leora Hyman. Thanks, kids, for coming and helping tonight. Just a few house cleaning chores. All of you, when you came, received an evaluation form. Please, on the way out, return it to the box on one of the two tables immediately outside of the room. This will help us at the Orthodox Union. It provides us with feedback as to what you liked, what you didn't like, what we should improve. And we are doing programs throughout the country. And we really need your help. We want to come back to Yavne. And we want to be able to even improve, if we can, on what we've done tonight. In addition to that, many of you were fortunate enough in receiving a booklet. The booklet had articles. Articles from the internet, as well as Jewish Action, which is the magazine of the Orthodox Union, with respect to the topics that were listed on the program. Read these articles. Look at them carefully. This is homework for you, but it's great homework because it will really reinforce what you heard tonight and give you some added skills. And I'd like to send you home with another message. The message is as follows. You know, we can always be critical. We could say, straighten up your room, stop hitting your brother, stop hitting your sister. Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? I want you to try to, and keep it in mind, even have a little chart at home. Research has shown that if you can hold the criticism and find five, do it at a 5-to-1 ratio, five positive things that your kids did to every criticism that you may state, you're in good shape. So that means you have to catch your kids doing something good. And if they're doing something good, tell them, but be genuine. Because there's nobody that you can fool who's a child or a teenager. So catch them doing something good. Praise, positive reinforcement. On behalf of the Orthodox Union, it's a pleasure being here tonight. We've gone so far beyond kashrus. We have the Community and Synagogue Services Division. Outside you will see pamphlets, materials on the table from Yachad, NCSY, the Israel Center, Jewish Action, the internet www.ou.org. You can catch so many programs having to do with Torah as well as parenting programs which have been archived. Tonight's program will be downloaded on MP3 and it'll be available for you or for your friends. Thank you very much for coming, especially on the Motzei Shabbos. It's great to see you here tonight. Thank you, Rabbi Knapp. For all you did to make this night happen. It indeed was a great pleasure, and for that I express my gratitude. As we know, this theme of gratitude is central to this morning's Kriyat HaTorah. We read this morning how Miriam waited by the water to watch carefully to see what would happen to her brother, Betetatav Miriam Merachok, Leita'ah Mayeh Salom. She watched carefully to see eventually what would happen to her brother Moshe. Chazal tell us that in the merit of her waiting, Bnei Yisrael would wait for her many years later in the Midbar. We will read in Ba'alotcha, Va'am lo nasa ad ha'asef Miriam. The entire nation refused to travel until Miriam would rejoin them. This was their way of demonstrating their gratitude to Miriam for what she had done for Moshe so many years earlier. Tonight's theme, as we know, is positive Jewish parenting. Parenting workshops are a major priority for us at Yavne Academy. At Yavne, we strive to join together to create children that are sophisticated and sensitive, caring and committed. We are so proud of our premier mental health program that carefully tends to the social and emotional needs of all of our children. We are proud to be at the cutting edge in providing proactive social programming up and down all of our grades. However, we fully understand that we cannot do this alone. And it's to that extent that we invoke this message from this morning's Kriya. We want to express our gratitude to you for not only coming out this evening, but for sharing this priority with us, for partnering with us in instilling those proper values in all of our children. May all of us be blessed with great success in this crucial and critical endeavor. And my final expression of gratitude this evening is to our keynote speaker, Rabbi Dr. Zvi Hirsch-Weinrib. A noted psychologist and acclaimed pulpit rabbi, he has served for the last number of years as the executive vice president for the Orthodox Union. Under his astute leadership, the OU has successfully spread its mission to thousands upon thousands of Jews worldwide. We express our collective gratitude to him for everything he has done and continues to do for the Jewish people over the course of a very distinguished career. And of course, tonight we express our gratitude to him for coming out and sharing with us his vast wisdom, expertise, and experience. It is now my great honor and pleasure to introduce Rabbi Dr. Zvi Hirsch-Weinrib.
First, I want to practice one of the skill sets that I heard from Mrs. Ellinger and from Dr. Pelkovich this evening. And that's how to give proper feedback to one's children. These are not my children, these are my staff. So I want to say to you, Frank, that, and to Josh here somewhere, and to Josh that we at the OU have great expectations of both of you and of your department. The expectations are that you will be able to give an impactful, informative, and interesting workshops all over the country for parents who are interested in learning more about parenting, that you'll be successful in organizing these workshops well, making sure that all the participants, if not the keynote speaker, has a parking space, and making sure that there's plenty of refreshments, although I didn't see the coffee. But the bagels, the chopped eggs, and the tuna fish were excellent. They came in handy from Lava Malka. We have the expectations that you will provide everybody here with things to take home, readings. We have an expectation that you will help us spread the word that the OU is so much more than kashrus, that we do so much else besides. And therefore, you have available for people to take home pamphlets and reading material about a wide variety of our programs outside your own department. We have an expectation that you will do an evaluation of your programs and take the evaluation seriously. And we have the expectation that you will make sure that you work cooperatively with institutions, schools, and shuls in all the communities. We want to say now that you're meeting these expectations very well. I won't say perfectly. We still haven't done a parenting workshop in New Orleans. But the Mirza Hashem will get there too. You've been to Chicago, to Los Angeles, to all points, north, east, south, and west of New York City. So we want to recognize your achievements in that regard and praise you for them specifically, and hope that you continue in your good work. How am I doing? Okay. I want to answer a question that was left hanging at the end of the last session that I sat in on, which was Dr. Pelkovitz's session. And I think it was this young woman in front of me who asked the following question. That sometimes in instilling Jewish values and ideals in our children, we are more successful than we like to be. And then we end up in the following quandary. We've been careful to send our children to a school which espouses religious Zionist principles, which believes in Medinat Yisrael and in the Yeshuv Eretz Yisrael and in Aliyah, which believes in serving your nation in all sorts of ways. And then we're finding out now that we've been so successful that our young 17-year-old son informs us that he's leaving home and he's joining the Israeli army. How do we handle that? We're deeply conflicted. How do we handle it? And Dr. Pelkovitz, who I happen to know because I'm invited to the wedding, has a wedding in his family tomorrow night, had to leave just after his presentation in order to pick up people who are coming into the wedding from the airport, etc. So he couldn't really give your question the attention that it deserves. And he kind of looked at me and asked if I had something to say, and I did, but the session was over. The microphone was saying, you know, time is up. So I thought I'd save it for the beginning of this talk. One of the words that I did not hear, doesn't mean that the word wasn't conveyed to you this evening, by the presenters of the workshop. It's a very, very important word, and the word is honesty. And one of the elements of successful parenting, and really of successful any type of human interaction, is honesty. One of the most valued of all descriptions of a person is that this person is a man of integrity. Interestingly enough, in the language of Chazal, an ish emunah is not a man of faith. Ish emunah is a man of integrity. Nososov and nosatov emuno is one of the first questions we're asked in the world to come. And it does not mean, did you have dealings with your fellows in faith? It means, were you a person of integrity? Were you honest? Were you a person of trust? And parents must be humans that children can trust, can believe in. And in that type of a situation, the one that was described, The way I would suggest handling it, and I think it's the way I would handle it, and have handled it in similar situations with my children, is to simply honestly convey what you're feeling. And to say, I'm very proud of you. I know where you got the idea from. It came from all of my mothering and all your father's fathering and all of your schooling. We're very proud of you, but you're still my baby. You'll always be my baby. One of the things that usually is not said in these workshops is that children remain your children throughout their lives. And I have grown children. I have a daughter who's a grandmother, and which makes me a great-grandfather. So now you have to have respect for me. And but they're still my kids. And my youngest, who's now a woman in her mid-30s and a mother herself, is still my baby. And I feel that way toward her, and therefore to this young man, we're very frightened. Entering the army, any army, is very risky, and we're very worried and concerned. And to share the fact that you yourself are conflicted. There's nothing wrong with being conflicted. I mean, if that's part of being human. You believe, and at the same time you don't believe. You're proud, and at the same time you're frightened. And sometimes, in this such a case, extremely frightened. But to share that with your child, and then he'll make his own decision, which he'll do whatever you say to him anyway. So you might as well open up and be honest, at least for your own purposes. I unlike Dr. Pelkovitz, I have started to look at this week's Parsha. I'm still not stuck with last week's Parsha. He kept giving examples from Yosef. I'd like to give one from Moshe. I'd like to share with you a very profound thought of Rav Kook. And Rav Kook often is difficult to understand because of his language, his mystical, poetic style. And in this case, his words are very brief and almost obscure. But I think I understand what he's saying, and if I don't understand it, then don't blame it on him. It's my fault. The Torah tells us in this week's Parsha that Moshe Rabbeinu was in the desert tending his flock, and he saw a burning bush. And he said, Asudo nova ere, I'm going to turn aside, I'm going to see what this burning bush is all about. And he saw the bush, etc. And then the Torah says that Vayaster Moshe ponov, Moshe hid his face, ki yorei mehabit el ha'elokim, because he was afraid to look at God. He knew that this snare somehow symbolically contained the divine image, and he was afraid to look at that image. And so he hid his face. The question is, was this reaction of Moshe, was this praiseworthy? Or was this something that he should be ashamed of? Was it an act of great humility? He confronted the divine, and he realized that in great awe of the divine that he had to hide his face. And this is a sign of great piety, spirituality, humility, a sense of the difference between the human and the divine. Or was he missing a wonderful opportunity? He had a chance to encounter God, and instead of doing so openly, he closed the curtain, so to speak. There's two ways of looking at it, positively and negatively. And interestingly enough, in the Gemara, we find a debate over just this point. And the passage is to be found in Maseches Brachos on Daf Zayin. The Gemara says, Tona Mishmeid Rav Yoshua ben Korcho. We learned the Braisa in the name of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Korcho. I don't know how many of you know this, but there's a Tosfos that says, I think it's a Tosfos in Maseches Chagiga, but maybe it's elsewhere. It says that Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcho was Rabbi Akiva's son. Anybody ever knew that before? Yeshua ben Korcho is Rabbi Akiva's son. But he's ben Korcho, not ben Akiva. Why is he called ben Korcho? So you may remember the various stories about Rabbi Akiva, that like many wise men, Rabbi Akiva was bald. And truly, one of Rabbi Akiva's contemporaries said of him that I can argue with anybody under the sun, chutz min hakereach hazeh, except for that bold one. With him, I can't argue, because Rabbi Akiva was known as the bold one, and Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha was a son of Rabbi Akiva. That's a tradition that's recorded by Tosfos. But that's nothing to do with the talk. It just has to do with the sensitivities of bald people and how proud we are of some of our those that we model ourselves after. But Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha said that God said to Moshe, "Kishirotzisi lo rotzisa achshav sha'ator rotze ani eini rotze." Later on, in 6, 7, 8 weeks down the road, we're going to read Parshas Kisisa. And there Moshe Rabbeinu asked God, "Hareini no es kodecha, I want to see you." And God says, "No way. Lo suchal liros es ponoi. You can't see my face." So Yeshua ben Karcha said, God said, when I wanted to show you my face, in this week's Parsha, at the burning bush, you didn't want to see me. Now, down the road, by the Chet HaEgel times, different circumstances, you want to see my face? You can't. When I wanted to, you didn't want. Now that you want, I don't want. So Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha interprets Moshe's hiding of his face as negative. He lost an opportunity to encounter God panim el panim, face to face, and he covered his face. However, the Gemara says, "Upligi Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachmani Yom Rabbi Yonason." Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha is arguing with Rabbi Yonason in this. Rabbi Yonason has a different point of view. He says, "Vischar shalosha zochol l'shalosha." That for the three components of Moshe's reflexive response of hiding his face, he hid his face because he feared to look at God. Three components. Hid, feared, to look. And so, Bishar vayaster Moshe ponov, because Moshe hid his face, zachol leklaster ponim. Moshe eventually had a glow. Ki koran or ponov. Moshe had a glow, a halo, a radiance to him. That radiance was something that he earned because he protected, he hid his face. V'schar ki yorei, because he feared to see God face to face, zocha vayiru migeshes elov. People were afraid to approach Moshe. He had the same, he projected a sense of awe to people similar to that which God projected to Moshe. And finally, Bishar may habit, because he refused to look at God, zocha, he was privileged eventually to the phrase, temunas Hashem yabit. In some way, Moshe was able to see God. So we have these two points of view. Was it positive or negative? Praiseworthy or not? That Moshe hid his face in this manner. And two points of view. So Rav Kook says, what are they arguing about? Was it positive or was it negative? And this, I just saw this afternoon. I just said, I've got to share this. It connects to what we're concerned with tonight in so many ways. From the Jewish point of view, who is the perfect person? The perfect man or woman? The epitome of shleimut. Who is that person? So, I had a constituent in my shul, who was a student of Rav Shechter, Shlita, in Yeshiva University. And he used to say he always passed the exam. Because whatever Rav Shechter asked him the exam, he would say, "Oh, it's a machlokas." Every question, "It's a machlokas." And Rav Shechter, because of his vast erudition, "Yeah, you know, you're right, there is a machlokas. I mean, there is somebody out there who holds a different point of view." It's a very safe way through Jewish life. You just say it's a machlokas. We just see it's a machlokes tanoim, whether Moshe was doing the good thing or not a good thing by hiding his face and not looking at God. But in this much more philosophical question, and one that relates very much to parenting, who is, from the Jewish point of view, the model person? It's a machlokes, it's a dispute between the two most important Jewish philosophers of all the history of Jewish philosophy. And they are Rambam, Maimonides, and Rabbi Bachya ibn Pekuda, the author of Chovas Halvavos, Duties of the Heart. The Rambam writes in all of his works, halachic and philosophic, and medical, that the model person is the person who has achieved the supreme height of intellect. For the Rambam, we understand why intellect is the ultimate perfection. And the person who has studied and mastered the sciences of his time and applied them to Torah and achieved divine wisdom, etc., but has grown intellectually to the apex of the pyramid of humanity, that's the perfect person. This is the Rambam's opinion. Rambam placed extreme value on intelligence, intellect, etc. The Chovas HaLevavos is a work, and the title of it tells you this, Duties of the Heart, that the perfect person is not the most supremely developed intellect. Quite the contrary. The Chovas HaLevavos adduces an entire list of brilliant intellectuals, Jew and non-Jew, who are far from moral paragons, who are morally imperfect. And he says that the model human being from a Jewish perspective is the person who has reached the epitome of ethical and moral behavior. The person who has mastered his heart, not the person who has mastered his mind. And this is an ongoing dispute. You can trace it down from 800, 900 years ago to this very day. Do we emphasize the intellect, or do we emphasize morals and ethics, which from the Chovas HaLevavos' psychology, morals and ethics are not matters of intellect and intelligence, they are matters of emotion and feeling and compassion. Two different models, two different very great, perhaps equally great, Jewish philosophers. When Moshe reacted by hiding his face in this way, he was denying himself the opportunity of achieving the Rambam's ideal. Imagine, if here at this earliest stage, his first encounter with God, he would have opened himself to the encounter face to face, he would have achieved a divine wisdom that would have surpassed anything in the history of humanity. Moshe instead chose not to act out of wanting to satisfy all of the intellectual curiosity which he could have satisfied by opening himself up to God. Instead, he hid his face with humility, with subjugation, effacing himself before God. He chose the way of the Chovas HaLevavos. He chose to show humility. He acted out of his heart, out of the reflexes of his emotional recoiling against seeing the supreme, ineffable God in front of him. So therefore, Rav Kook says, Rabbi Yoshua ben Korcha, he was following the Rambam's approach. And he said Moshe really blew an opportunity here. He missed a chance to achieve supreme intellectual satisfaction. And because of that, he blew it. We have to look at it negatively. Rabbi Yonason, on the other hand, looked at it from the point of view of the author of the Chovas HaLevavos. And he said, look, the man had this tremendous opportunity, but instead he was so overwhelmed with a sense of awe, with a sense of the spirituality of the moment, with a sense of his own inadequacy, that he hid his head, he hid his face. And that's a sign of the person who will grow to be the humblest of all men, the person who is a master of the Chovas HaLevavos, of the duties of the heart. It's a beautiful piece of homiletics, and extremely provocative, as all of Rav Kook's thoughts are. But what does it have to do with us? So I'd like to take you to an experience I had relatively recently, also on the Motsoi Shabbat, maybe 8 weeks or so ago, and that was the Motsoi Shabbat of Shabbos Chol HaMoed Sukkos. My wife and I, Chavi and I, were in Israel, in Yerushalayim. And whenever I'm in Israel and Yerushalayim, I try to spend Motsoi Shabbat at one of the programs of OU Israel. We have a branch, a department, a network of programs in Israel, which itself is something to see. And if any one of you can get away from January 20th to January 27th to join us on our OU mission, there's still enough room for you to sign on. But whenever I have the opportunity, there's one program we have that is called Zula. Z-U-L-A. Zula is a word, it might be an Arabic word, I think someone told me it was a Turkish word. And it simply means a hangout for teenagers. And that's what Zula is. It's a place for teenagers in Yerushalayim to come and to hang out on a Saturday night when they have no place else to go. And there, it's a comfortable environment, at least comfortable for 17-year-olds. You sit on the floor, so it's not so comfortable for great-grandfathers. There's a wax candle in the center. The room is dimly lit. So someone's playing guitar. Everyone's free to join in with his or her musical instruments. They're singing, storytelling, etc. The kids who this is designed for are children who are in great difficulty. Often, characteristically, they're kids from our family, either American kids who are stuck in Israel, ran away to Israel, or whose parents think they're studying in Israel, or they're Israeli kids, again, from our kinds of kids, our families, yours and mine. But for whatever reasons, they've dropped out, and they're living on the streets of Yerushalayim. And the streets of Yerushalayim are not what the prophet Isaiah prophesied yet. All right? They're not places of great joy and great harmony and wonderful tzedako mishpat. They're places of danger, great danger, physical danger. They're places of promiscuity, of immoral behavior of all kinds. They're places where drugs of all kinds, beginning with alcohol, ending with Lord knows what, are freely available. And these kids are living on the streets and taking part in all of the above activities. And by Saturday night, 2 o'clock in the morning, they are, whatever the word is nowadays, stoned, plastered, bombed, whatever. And they need a place to be which is safe, which is warm in the winter, and air-conditioned in the summer, and a place where they can connect. And they come to Zula by the dozens. And any Saturday night, if you go there, there are 100, 200 kids there. And we have trained counselors who are there, who meet them where they're at, and who try to move them, they're at the pretty close to the bottom of the pit, and try to move them upwards. We're successful with some, not successful with others. It's an extremely important and impressive program. And I visited there last Cholamoy Sukkos, and took along with me, as I always try to do, several other people, people who are in the position perhaps to help us out financially to run these kinds of programs, people who would be interested themselves or educators or psychologists, etc., to take them to this environment. And we took along several friends of ours or acquaintances of ours to see. And after we saw, we withdrew to a little conference room and we met with the fellow who runs it, whose name is Harel Chetzroni. And someone asked him the following question. To what do you attribute this phenomenon? These are not isolated kids. There's not three or four kids. These are kids by the dozens, if not hundreds. They're kids more or less from what you would call modern Orthodox backgrounds, broadly defined. They're good kids. They're all good kids. It doesn't take long to talk to them. You can see the core of goodness, of decency, of in them, but they've gone very far astray. What do you attribute it to? And I was expecting, because I know when I'm asked that kind of a question, I start being both a psychologist and a rabbi and a great-grandfather, and I say, well, it's very complex, there are many reasons, and not just one reason, you have to look at the sociological background and the this and the that and the blah, blah, blah. And all right, I can see things very in very complex, nuanced terms. But Chetzroni, he's a very simple person, straight to the point. He said, there's one reason. Every one of these kids, practically without exception, has gone to one of our religious high schools. Sometimes in the States, sometimes in Israel. And the high schools emphasize the intellect. And they emphasize grades. And they emphasize information. and they emphasize tests and exams. And they do not emphasize, and sometimes do not even mention, the chovot halavavot, the heart, the soul, the spirit. They don't instill in these kids a sense of identity to who they are. They certainly do not spiritually connect them to God. In fact, as you know, you can easily go, as I did, through 4 years of yeshiva high school, and God is never mentioned. You can study an entire tractate of Talmud, and the word God is not mentioned. Because there are tractates of Talmud which are very, very legalistic. And yes, if you're taught that this legal system ultimately depends upon the will of God, etc., etc., you can make the connections to God, but usually they're not mentioned. I remember once, some years ago, when Rabbi Lamb was confronted with this question by a critique of the Yeshiva High School system of Yeshiva University. And he was asked, where is God in your curriculum? Hopefully many schools have improved since then. But by and large, this is still the picture. And this was Chetzroni's point of view. And in my terminology, in Rav Cook's terminology tonight, the Rambam's view is only one view. Only he was the one who said that intellect, intellect, intellect is the name of human perfection. But there's another point of view, and obviously that was Moshe's point of view, that it's more important to emphasize the obligations of the heart. It's more important to teach honesty, humility, compassion, empathy, forgiveness, integrity, etc., than it is to teach information, etc. And certainly there has to be a balance. The overemphasis on just intellect, according to Chetzroni, who's dealt with hundreds, if not thousands, of these kids, is his answer, and he may be right, he may be wrong, he may be partially right. Even if he's partially right, it's something to think about. So from that point of view, I want to share with you my own definition of Jewish parenting. I emphasize Jewish parenting. You'll note that all of our workshops are called positive Jewish parenting. And part of that, but at my own insistence, because there's a difference, I maintain, between good parenting, which is very important, and there are books, libraries full of good material on good parenting, and then there's good Jewish parenting, which is something different. And there's very little written about that. So I want to maintain that parenting, from a Jewish perspective, is done within a religious framework. It must be conceived of as a sacred duty. It's not, quote, just parenting. It's part of your sacred duty. A father and a mother are playing the most important roles in Jewish society. Look at Jewish society, from wherever you want to trace it, back to now. There is no more important role. The role of the rabbi is, for centuries and perhaps millennia, was non-existent. The role of prophet, for 2,000 or more years, has been non-existent. All of the roles in Jewish life are transitory. There are times in history where they're important, times in history where they're not. But father and mother are religious roles that were important from the time of Avraham and Sarah till this very day, and perhaps more important now than then. So it's a sacred duty. And it can only be accomplished with the proper thoughtfulness, preparation, planning, and siyata dishmaya. You've got to do your part, but you've got to do a heck of a lot of praying along with it. Because ultimately, like everything else we do humanly, but certainly parenting, it's got to be done with siyata dishmaya. And our grandmothers, great-grandmothers, whoever invented those prayers, most of which were written in Yiddish, that one says, that women say when they light the candles, and now have been translated to Hebrew and to English, etc., when you light the candles Friday night and you pray to God for children and a certain type of children, there are various versions of these techinot. This is one place to pray to God for help with this process. But it's a process. And I want to emphasize the process. It doesn't happen I mean, you're going to go home tonight, you heard a few good ideas, you're going to try them. Some may work, some may not work. It's not a one-time deal. There are no magic buttons to push. It's a long-term process. And believe me, if obviously sitting in the audience, you can confirm it. When your kids are 40, you're still going to be doing parenting. It's a process. It's complex, and it's characterized by success and failure. There are ups and there are downs. To accomplish it properly, one must be mindful of its goals and objectives. What are you trying to accomplish? I'm going to suggest four goals or objectives. Number one, a Jewish parent wants to teach his, her children a sense of self, conveying to the child that he has a name. And one of the first things that you do as a parent is select a name for your child. And that name, the name that you select, is perhaps the first step, maybe not the first step, but a very early step in your parenting. The name has tremendous meaning. I ask you just for a moment to reflect on your own names and what meaning that has for you. And you'll find the more you reflect on it, the more you realize how much meaning that has. I was named for a great-grandfather whose name was Tzvi Hirsch. And obviously, I never met him. But I know he has influenced me in ways that he'll never know and I'll never know. And some ways that I do know in my life. And I would have been a different person had my mother, father chosen for me a different name. Either a different ancestor or some name they picked out of the book. I was born Parshas Kisisa. They could have called me Moshe, Aaron, Egel Azov. They could have called me all sorts of things. And all those names would have been meaningful, obviously. Moshe, Aaron for sure. But the fact that they chose Tzvi Hirsch, the fact that Hirsch is Yiddish and not Hebrew, the fact that Tzvi is not a biblical name for people, it's a name of an animal. All of these things have tremendous significance, symbolic, sometimes unconscious, mythical significance. But the name you give a child is extremely important. And that begins to help form his or her sense of self. Responsibilities, skills, competencies, etc. The sense of self is extremely important. And you've heard much about this tonight in various other talks. Number two, extremely important. A sense of family. It's interesting to me, I worked when I was a rabbi in Baltimore, I worked very, very closely with the Jewish Federation. And extremely closely with Jews who were not Orthodox, were not religious, were not knowledgeable, etc. And it always interested me that there were a couple of Yiddish or Hebrew words that they did know. Shabbos was not even necessarily one of them. Chutzpah was one of them. That's something everyone knows. But one thing that these people knew was the term mishpacha. We're all mishpacha. We're all part of a family. If there's one thing we should have learned over the past 8-10 weeks of reading the Torah, is that we are a family. Yes, we're a family that sells its brother down the river. We're a family that fights with each other. We're a family that can't get along. We're a family that's suspicious of each other. We're a rebellious family, a diverse family, etc., etc. Perhaps even a dysfunctional family. But we are a family. And that started with Avraham and Sarah, etc., and it goes right down to today. We argue, etc., etc. We have our family differences, but we're a family. And the child has to know that he has a home. He has to have a sense of comfort, acceptance, belongingness, and that the family has a future, and that the future is with the family. Number three, a sense of Jewish identity. And here I want to share with you a story that one of our NCSY regional directors, director of our NCSY region in Canada, Toronto, Glenn Black, Rabbi Glenn Black, shared with me. And it's a story he told at a recent NCSY dinner. I'll give it to you in his words. Allow me to share with you a sad and telling story I recently heard from a survivor. He was scheduled to visit his doctor for his annual medical checkup. The young Jewish nurse that would see him and prep him asked the elderly man to roll up his sleeve so she could take his blood pressure. As he slowly rolls his sleeve up, the young nurse chuckles. The man asks the nurse, "Why are you smiling?" "Oh," she says, "you really shouldn't write your phone number on your arm. It's bad for you." Glenn then tells the rest of the story. Where do you think this happened? Omaha, Kansas City, Borough Park? The answer is Yerushalayim. But what Glenn didn't say in his speech, but which he's told me privately, is what kind of education do you think this young Jewish nurse had? She was a product of one of our finest American religious Orthodox schools. Now you can say she was a poor student. She didn't get it. She missed the lesson on the Holocaust. I don't know what you could say in defense of her, and I'm certainly not blaming her. But if we haven't conveyed a sense of the Holocaust, a sense of who survivors were, etc., a sense of what those letters on the arm really mean, something is missing. But let's not criticize the school or whatever. But let's commit as parents to make sure that our kids have a sense of Jewish identity. That means a lot. It means stuff related to the Holocaust. It means stuff related to Jewish history. It means stuff related to anti-Semitism. It means pride in Jewish Nobel Prize winners. It means all sorts of things. But it's a parent's responsibility, as well as the school's, to teach the child a sense of Jewish identity. Establishing an attitude that you, child, are a member of the Jewish people, that is a great privilege, something to be proud of, and it brings with it obligations and benefits. A concept of shared history and destiny and all that means. So far, three goals: teaching a sense of self, teaching a sense of family, teaching a sense of Jewish identity, and finally, and with this I'll conclude, teaching a sense of spirituality. Teaching your child that this, the school, I would maintain, can do only minimally and can only happen in the home. That the child develop a relationship with God. And I want to close with one of my pet peeves, and many people have said, "Weinreb, you're nuts. This is nothing to be concerned about, etc." But I'll share it with you and you can judge it for yourself. These days, most of the time, when we refer to God, we call God Hashem. That's the term we use for God. In all the art scroll translations of God, he's always Hashem. Hashem means the name. Hashem is extremely impersonal, the name. I pray to the name. I hope for the name. I put my trust in the name. Psychologically, that's not what you're doing. And here I turn to one of my role models in spirituality, and that was my maternal grandmother and her mother, great-grandmother, who I was privileged to know. When they had a difficulty with God, they didn't say Hashem. They said Ribono Shel Olam, Master of the Universe. They said Tata in Himmel, Father in Heaven. They said, and in this audience, I imagine this word will be the first time you hear it, but it's a common Yiddish word, Der Barm Dike Gott, which means the merciful God. Or they would say HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Or they would say, the Oibishter, the Eibishter, the High One. Because if there's one important element of Jewish philosophy that we all must get back in touch with, that is that Judaism believes in a personal God. In a God who acts as a person, is described throughout the Tanakh as a person. Yes, there are philosophical difficulties. Does God have eyes and a long-stretched arm and a mighty hand and ears, etc.? That's for philosophers to worry about. But the experience, not the intellectual experience of the Rambam, but the heartfelt experience of the Chovos al Bovos, is it's a personal relationship. You can turn to him anytime you want. You can be angry with him. You can be happy with him. You can be thankful to him. You can consult with him. You can rage against him, etc. Try your heart out to him. But he's a personal God. And to call him the name just doesn't do it. It doesn't convey the sense of God as a person. And I was privileged to see my grandmother and great-grandmother turn to the Tata in Himmel, to the God in heaven, the Father in heaven, when the challah didn't rise properly, and, seriously, and when they began to find out that their sisters and brothers and cousins were being burnt in the ovens of Belzec. They would turn, with their own words, to Tata in Himmel. And that's an extremely powerful, powerful lesson to learn. I'm not preaching to you, God forbid, and I'm certainly not telling you something which is mystical or I don't, this is basic Judaism. Alright, this is basic Judaism. Baruch Atah Hashem. You address God in the second person. Not even the third person. But people stopped addressing me in the third person, in the second person. You know that? People come over to me and say, is the rabbi comfortable? Oh, did the rabbi find a parking space? And I wonder, like, which rabbi? But that's protocol. But God doesn't ask for that. You don't address him in the third person. You say, Baruch Atah. And you address him in the second person. That the personal connection is the essence of Jewish spirituality. And that's part of a parent's responsibility. So I've given you four objectives. They're big ones and tall ones, but I think they're important ones in what it means to be a Jewish parent. I want to thank you for listening, certainly for coming out on a Motzoi Shabbos. I wish you a good day.